All right, let's head over to the Zoom line. We have Canada's greatest export, Terry Edom, on the line with us here today. How are you doing today, sir?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an author, books available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it's the end of the fossil fuel insanity, right?
Yeah, it is, yep.
And then there's the BOE report, which is a popular energy publication. You're also a columnist for them. And back in the old days when people were blogging, you'd do a blog called Public Energy Number One. And last time we spoke, that was kind of third on your hobby list. How's that doing these days?
It is. It's kind of parked. I spend most of my day on the BOE report. When I will get back to my blog someday. It's kind of a changing world, I guess. So.
Yeah, well, you get most of the stuff done on the BOE report anyway.
That's
so
correct. Yeah,
and the Public Energy Number One, I know you were hanging on to because it had such a cool name, and you just wanted to hang on to it that way. But Terry Edom up in Canada, Calgary, Alberta, Canada, to be more specific, and he also has his toe dipped in the natural gas industry as well as the media and publishing industry. And we'd like to get an update from time to time what's happening north of the border. And I got a few notes jotted down, but let's start with natural gas. It's an area that you are in on a day-to-day basis. So what's the natural gas report from Canada this month?
Well, it's up and down, I would say. So up until a couple of months ago, things were looking great. Canada's first LNG export terminal is just coming into service now, starting to draw a little bit of gas. It'll be exporting next year. So that's a couple of BCF a day out of an 18 BCF market, so production market. So that's a big deal. That's awesome. And then the AI data center boom is taking hold, just like in the US. It's that kind of came out of nowhere. I would say like a little over a year ago, no one was talking about that. And now the demand ranges from impressive to outrageous for natural gas. I've heard estimates of between 3 to 15 BCF of new demand from like Kinder Morgan and parties like that. So that's very exciting. In the past couple of weeks, the damper in Canada here has been the likely arrival of Trump tariffs, 25% on everything coming out of Canada, which he's just recently, Mr. Trump has recently said that it'll hit everything, every export out of Canada and out of Mexico. So maybe it won't hit drugs. I don't know.
I'll tell you what, that's been a talk of the one of the coffee with the kind of the local media people here. I go and have coffee with every now and then. I'm in the western part of Minnesota right now.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And kind of try to get that next chapter, you know, with the house on the river going type thing. So that's where I'm spending my time right now. My son is 45 miles away in North Dakota. And so he was complaining about that tariff because his wife's from Canada. So they go up there every other weekend and they bring back like rye bread and they bring back like, what is it, Kraft mac and cheese, because it's totally different in Canada than it is in America. And so, yeah, he's got this bootleg Canadian stuff he brings down 3 hours from the border, man.
Oh, get him Hawkins cheesies. You need him to get those too.
That's the other one.
Oh,
yeah.
You're awesome. Yeah.
I put an order in for Macintosh caramels, but I've yet to see those.
Oh, they don't make it home.
They used to have those when I was a kid, but I think too many kids got diabetes because it was just a brick of sugar, man. It was so good. But
it's so good.
Hey, I did want to ask you this because I did have down in my notes I was going to ask you about AI data centers. That is a new fad that is really taking off in the United States. So I wanted to see if it was picking up in Canada. Sounds like it is. So I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on the AI data center, because what a lot of people don't understand is that it is tied to oil and gas, because the way that these AI data centers are increasing the grid when it comes to cities, it's doubling what a city would put out for energy. In Williston, North Dakota, there's now big problems. In fact, the city might be facing some lawsuits now because they want to...
Wow.
But yeah, they want to basically
The demand.
the price, basically have all the citizens pay for this new data center at the end of the day, Atlas or something like that. I can't remember it, but for 40 years, Terry, the energy bill was here. All of a sudden, a data center comes in, and the energy bill's here. And here the electric company says, well, we should have the people pay for it, and so that's the first thing is the subsidy is kind of a reverse subsidy for some of these data centers, because in America they're finding out that, like Tesla, they're just sucking the energy out of the grid and they're not really paying their fair share, and they're looking at the common good to pay for it. And that's really just kind of a subsidy at the end of the day. I don't know how you guys view it in Canada, but here that's how it's viewed a lot of times. And here's the second thing I want you to comment on when it comes to the AI data centers, because you're in the natural gas world. And I got a text from somebody in Western North Dakota that said, it's really interesting that the way these data centers are going in, it's almost like they're trying to artificially inflate the price of natural gas in order to make it viable for the oil companies to make money off it, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think it's about time that we make some money off natural gas. I mean, to take a hydrocarbon molecule and ship it from Fort Tuna, North Dakota, down to South America, you should probably pay more than $3. But that's just my opinion, Terry. I mean, it's not the U.S. mail we're talking about here. But so I just kind of laid a lot out there for a second. But talk to me a little bit about the AI, the grid, and natural gas prices.
Sure. So it's a big topic, so I'll be as succinct as I can. But AI kind of came up out of nowhere, the capability of it. I think ChatGPT was one of the first, and it showed the capability. And then companies like Tesla started showing the potential of it. And then Musk went out and built his own in like 19 weeks or some monster facility. And so there's this, as everybody knows now, there's a competitive imperative to get in on the AI game. If you're not in, you're going to get left behind. And I think that's across every industry, pretty much automotive, healthcare, manufacturing, government, even everywhere, research. And the curious thing about AI data centers is that the bigger and more powerful you build them, the better they are, the better your competitive advantage, which if you think about that, that's just going to ratchet everything up. So how much can you afford to spend on data centers? Well, if you're a big tech company, then you want to spend more than your rival. I think it was Microsoft that said they're going to spend $80 billion in 2025 on data. It's like insane amount of money, and that's double what it was not that long ago. That's one company. I found a forecast from last June that said the forecast for 2025 AI data centers was a crazy estimate at the time, was going to be like $240 billion. Now there's like three companies that account for 170 billion of that in 2025. That's how quickly things are changing. And so the thing about data centers is they have to be attached to the grid. They obviously they need 24/7 power. And the most logical thing to do is put them right beside a natural gas field, because then you can avoid the grid in theory. It doesn't work this way, but that's where you'd like to have it, because then you can just produce the natural gas, generate power, you got your data center, Bob's your uncle. But what these things want, redundancy, and they want the ability to their power demand can actually fluctuate, so which doesn't work well with their own standalone power plants. So they want to be connected to the grid. And then you get into the problem that you're talking about. How do you bolt on all of this new demand onto an existing grid? And the natural gas guys are saying, hey, we can build power plants all day long to connect to the grid. But there's a lot of regulations and red tape and issues with doing that, including how do you smooth out the billing on all this sort of thing. And then the compounding factor, what's making this all much worse, and what you touched on about the bills for consumers. I don't know if it's a scheme to drive up gas prices, but I think for the people that are using these data centers, the money that's available to them dwarfs the power cost, and they literally don't care. It's a rounding error compared to what they think they will earn with their AI tool. And so, and all of the big players said, we want green power. They came out of the chute saying, hey, we're going to do these things renewable. They realized, well, that ain't going to happen. Wind and solar are too intermittent and they're a long time lag. And then they thought, okay, well, we'll get nuclear plants. So they, one of the big ones, I think it was Microsoft or Google or somebody, they signed up Three Mile Island to restart that. Somebody went to Pennsylvania and glommed onto their nuclear plant that's existing, but that got shot down by the regulator because the regulator rightly is saying, well, I'd say rightly, but for, in the public interest, they're saying, you're not going to hog all the baseload power, the clean baseload power, and take it away from consumers, and they'll be left with nothing else when they need it. So there's, so the grid itself couldn't adapt to renewables in the way that it was being asked to. There's jurisdictions in the U.S. that were being forced to shut down coal and natural gas-fired power plants because of federal legislation that it's, over time they have to be phased out. So that was a big enough problem for the grid. Now you add on this new demand, which kind of came out of nowhere, and it's absolutely huge. So it's incredibly destabilizing to a grid that was not ready to handle the future anyways. So, but the balancing equation here is going to be natural gas. And now you have an administration coming in, which is not against hydrocarbons. It's quite in favor of natural gas. And I think the Trump administration is going to be in favor of seeing the U.S. at the forefront of the AI revolution and the natural gas industry. So I think the industry is just poised for phenomenal growth here if the Trump administration can pave the way or clear the path, I should say, is a better word for it, for to deregulate what needs to be done to meet this demand.
One of the things that is popping up too as well in conjunction with the data centers and the rush of data centers is there is a pretty good mad rush for carbon sequestration projects. And when you take a look at what's happening here is the fossil fuel industry is racing to these carbon sequestration projects because the regulators are forcing them to. And the AI carbon data, I mean, it's now a triangle, because in order to have the AI data center, you have to have the carbon pipeline. And in order to have the AI center, you're going to need some natural gas, and they need the pipeline too. So there's this weird triangle, and I'm sure that it's probably a pentagram at the end of the day, because there's ag in there too and a few other things. But you see what I mean, Terry? Like, the AI data centers do not exist without natural gas. They just do not exist. Nuclear maybe down the line, right, but not right now. It's natural gas.
They want it yesterday. They don't want to wait 10 years for right. Nuclear. Yeah.
And so. Here you got, you know, we're going to be talking to Tom Shepstone here a little bit later today. He's up in New York. Their governor's trying to fine oil and gas companies $1 trillion in New York. So what do you make of the carbon industry? Because it is completely tied to the AI data centers, which are completely tied to the natural gas. And in ethanol, the oil and the crude oil industry is now tied to ethanol, which is tied to the carbon industry too. So you got three little, I knew we'd get a pentagram, because you put two triangles together, you get the pentagram. What do you got?
Well, I think something has to give here, and I think that it's going to be the carbon sequestration piece of the puzzle, because for the reason that it's very slow moving to build carbon pipelines, they're facing pushback in the U.S. and elsewhere. You build a new pipeline anywhere and it faces pushback. But there, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a big carbon line somewhere in the northern U.S. that got shot down. So they're going to have challenges to build carbon sequestration. And it's not a carbon sequestration works. There's two ways it can work. One is it's enhanced oil recovery. And so that's proven in Texas and places like that, where it's a flood, miscible flood that helps you recover oil, inject CO2 underground, cycle it. It's a beautiful scheme. It helps you recover oil more efficiently. and it's a use for CO2. You can ultimately sequester it. There's the pure, and then there's the pure CO2 sequestration, where you're just sequestering it with no economic benefit. And that's much more costly and much more difficult to achieve, because it's high capital to do it. But pipeline is expensive.
But Terry, in North Dakota, we have both. So mm-hmm. we have the high costly storage potential, which is billions of dollars from the taxpayers. So, you know, I don't know, 50 some ethanol plants can continue on. And then on the enhanced oil recovery, in fact, they just put out an article this week that they're so far away from figuring out the secret sauce. And I bet there's been, I don't know, $5 billion in the past 10 years pumped into one public-private partnership in order to figure it out, this, you know, secret sauce with all these globalist corporations and that sort of thing. And all they do is, I'm being totally serious, Terry, when I say this, and I know some people are going to get really ticked off in the oil and gas industry, but I don't care, because the proof is in the pudding and in the body of work. There are some in some areas where they're becoming like wind and solar, because they're not hitting their marks, and they keep saying, give me more money, give me more money, more public money, give me more of the taxpayer dollars, and I'll keep my $250,000 salary and keep going to all the events and keep showing you on social media how much money I'm spending, but I'm not going to hit my mark. And right. It's starting to happen in the oil and gas industry, specifically in enhanced oil recovery. And that's a shame, because it does work in Texas. It does right. work in Australia, I believe, is the other place where it works pretty well. But I mean, there's some areas where it just doesn't work. And no matter how much you take Tuscaloosa, Alabama, we could frack there all day long if it was $195,000 per barrel in oil, but we can't get, you know what I mean? It's like $200 right. barrel oil. Maybe we could frack there, but it ain't going to happen. So maybe right. it will one day, but sorry, I went off on my little soapbox there, Terry. What do you make of that? You know,
there's a lot of angles to that. One is that the enhanced oil recovery doesn't work in every reservoir, and I'm not sure that it works in shale reservoirs at all. And the Bakken shale could be one of those. That I'm not a petroleum geologist, but I suspect that it doesn't work that well. It's that's a very tight formation, and it only works by fracking. So to do a CO2 flood isn't the same as an old school super porous, super permeable reservoir where you can flush the oil out or kind of scrub it out, which CO2 does. So they're different beasts. So a modern shale field may not be amenable to EOR in the same way. And but the fact remains that it's just, if the reservoir is not one that's super amenable to CO2 flooding, or it doesn't work that well, then you're spending a lot of capital and the only gain you're getting out of it is the carbon credit aspect of it. We're seeing that in Canada too. Like, the only ones that are moving ahead are ones that are underwritten by the federal government, where they've guaranteed a price for carbon for decades to come. Yeah. And if you don't have that, the economics of it just don't work. It's a lot of money. And actually, even scavenging the CO2 off a big power plant is not an easy thing to do. It's one engineer described it to me as like, it's like a jet engine coming out of there with a massive volume of hot gas, and only a fraction of that is CO2. And you have to capture it and cool it and then liquefy it and inject it, and it takes a ton of power just to do that alone. And then the pipeline has to be specific pipeline, and if you build a CO2 pipeline to an injection site, that injection site doesn't last forever. It fills up too. You can inject easily for a while, and then over time it can't absorb it, then you have to build a new segment of pipe somewhere else, and it's wildly costly. And it's a whole new, the CO2 sequestration industry as a emission saving mechanism is a whole new industry in a sense. You have to find the right reservoir, the right characteristics, the right location. It has to be co-located close to a power plant, unless you want to build them together. If you want to build a new power plant in conjunction with the CO2 scheme, you have to find the right place for it. It can be done, they exist, but they're not everywhere. It's very complicated and expensive, and it's part of this what I wrote about in my book years ago. This green energy transition was just rushed into without people thinking of the cost or the consequences or even the capability of doing it. If you just say to a layperson or to a academic that's just studies the superficial literature of this thing, that CO2 sequestration makes sense. Well, absolutely it does as a solution, but then you put the boots on the ground and go make it happen. It's just like so many other things out there. They're great ideas, but and they work, but can they work economically? That's the challenge. Just like wind is a phenomenal thing. Does it work economically? That's the challenge. Solar is the same thing. And they work as a part of the solution. Solar is great for clipping peak demand, especially in some regions of the U.S. Wind is great in some regions of the U.S. CO2 sequestration is great in some regions of the U.S. But to enforce this as a blanket solution across an industry, it's just not going to happen unless governments want to spend more trillions of dollars underwriting something that isn't going to make money. So in certain pockets, it'll work great, but...
Are you guys using geothermal?
Same thing. Geothermal works great in certain places. A lot of places, there are heat maps, underground heat maps that geologists have developed from well data that tell you where some places are hotter than others. Some it's closer to the surface. Some formations it doesn't work. If you think about geothermal, the mechanics of it. So you drill a well and you frack it. Then what? You have to pump the water down or the heating material and then pump it back up, which takes a bunch of energy. And eventually reservoirs cool too. So if you keep doing that cycle long enough, there's a company in Canada called Ever. They developed an Ever Loop, and they have two sites about a mile apart or a couple miles apart, and they drill horizontal wells and they just have a big loop. And it's the most brilliant idea I've ever come across for geothermal. And they built a pilot here in Canada, and it works mechanically, but the power prices here aren't high enough to justify it. And they've never built another one. They've gone to Germany and are building one there where they got massive government money to do it. And so geothermal works, again, it works very well in some areas. It works perfectly in Iceland, and it will work perfectly in some areas of the U.S. where there's a lot of heat close to the surface. And there are people developing using underground oil and gas reservoirs to store heat. You pump a medium down in there and you can heat it up and then release that when you need it. These are all great ideas, but they're all going to be regional. And it's going to take a lot of time to get these to be economic. So,
are you wearing a 9-inch nail shirt?
I am.
That's what I thought. I was going to ask you if Broken or Downward Spiral was a better album, but...
Oh, good question.
Yeah, I know. Which one?
Downward Spiral that's still in my playlist.
That's like asking to pick between your children. Come on now. What's going on here? Yeah. Trent Reznor, I really gained a lot of respect for him, and I had a lot of respect for him already just from his music. Folks, we're talking about 9-inch Nails. It's a I don't know, heavy metal band, I guess would probably be what it's called. But he wrote Hurt, that Johnny Cash remade.
Mm-hmm.
And when he heard Johnny Cash's version of Hurt, he said, "Well, that song is no longer mine." He's like, that's Johnny's song now.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, because he wrote it from a young 20-some-year-old. So there was still hope in the world, and there was still some things. So it was a totally different energy. And then go look at Johnny Cash's, and he's writing about the end of his life, after being a drug abuser. And like, I almost break out in tears watching it sometimes because you can you can just feel it. And so,
yeah. I just saw someone on Twitter the other day call that, and I forget who it was, but somebody that made a lot of music videos, somebody like Bono or something like that. And they call that the greatest music video ever made. And I can't dispute that.
Yeah.
It
definitely be in the top, I always say in the top three or top five, because it's hard to, say best one ever because you know circumstances
I
change
couldn't
and
do
roads
that,
change.
but yeah, it's right up there. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
so powerful. Yeah.
And the other story about Nine Inch Nails, this could have been Tool, who I also like a lot. Man, they got some really unique music. But I believe this is a Nine Inch Nails story here where they were coming out with a concert basically. And so they put out a bunch of, what was it, to their fans. They sent out like a blast email and had everybody show up to this abandoned location and made everybody wait for like an hour or two or something like that. A bunch of people left, this and that. Well, then a bus came or somebody came and picked them up or anyway, they let them on like three or four little kind of goose chases, and each one got creepier
Sounds
and
like cool.
creepier. And of course, the 12 people that made it out of the 2,000 that showed up originally got backstage passes. They got autographed guitars. It was
Earned
like, hey, man, you survived Saw, so we were going to give you the loot. And so I think it might have been Tool, but for some
Yeah,
reason,
it
I
sounds like
just
that.
thought it was Nine Inch Nails. Either
I
way,
like them both.
horse a piece of that one right there with those two bands on that.
Yep.
Well, anything else happening in Canada that we should know about here as we kind of wind down? I know you got some articles we should probably plug, and anything else that's happening?
Those are the key things that are we like I said, we're excited about the arrival of LNG and better prices hopefully out of that, and a lot of Canadian gas gets sold in the US market, which is looking up, things are looking up there too with all the new LNG terminals. So there's some enthusiasm, but until the Trump tariff thing is settled, that's just like a total wet blanket over the industry up here until we know what's going to happen there. So
So, do you
there's
think that is going to have a pretty big impact on the oil and gas industry?
I think it would. I think it would be it well, it's actually, frankly, it's hard to see how it gets implemented because it's such an integrated energy market. Like in some ways it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Like a lot of US like Trump says, we don't need Canadian oil. It's like, well, you actually do. The US produces 13 million barrels a day and it consumes 20. So you need oil from somewhere. Might as well get it from the guy up north, right across the unguarded border. We have the pipeline connections. A lot of US refineries are actually designed to run on Canadian crude or heavy crude, which they can. The historic sources were Mexico and Venezuela, and Mexico's output has collapsed, and Venezuela is Venezuela. So Canadian crude fills that void. And so to say you don't need Canadian crude is like really not a good summation of it at all. And on the natural gas side, the US consumes all it is turning into a bigger exporter, and it needs Canadian imports. And also the US actually exports a lot of natural gas to Canada as well. Some goes in from the western side into the western side of the country, and then it goes US gas goes north into Canada in the Ontario Quebec region. So it's a very integrated market. So to slap a tariff on energy kind of doesn't make sense. But at the same time, I understand what Trump is doing. He's saying like we've had enough of a lot of very shoddy governance in Canada and Mexico, like the sloppy borders, the immigrants getting through. Like we can see that too. It's an embarrassment. Canada's overrun with people that we just had no screening and we just let them land here. And I think a lot of them just run across the border into the US. And I understand the frustration with that because there's a big element. It's a bit of everything, right? Good, bad, and ugly. And so I understand the need to say we need to control these things and we need to coerce Canada to get their act together. Totally get that. And so I think that the pressure is going to come, whether it makes sense or not. But I think it's going to, and I think Trump's position is we're just going to do a blanket. I'm not sorting out this mess. You sort it out. But the hammer's coming down until you get your act together.
Yeah, I think
And
there's a term for that.
it's
They call it a mooch. A
mooch.
mooch. Yeah, you Canadian moochers. And
Yeah.
you Canadian moochers mooching off of our
Well, that's another thing too. We spend nothing on our military, right? It's just,
Do
I think
you
there's
guys have
a,
a military? Like, seriously.
I know a couple people in the military,
I
so
mean,
I, we do, but
is it anything of size or anything like that?
no, it's nothing of size, and it's an embarrassment up here for a lot of people how our government has our federal government is continuously underspent on the military, and our fighting forces are good fighting forces, but they're chronically underfunded. They have old equipment. They're just like, it's a neglected part of the economy. It's all gone to green nonsense. And we spend $10 billion subsidizing a battery plant in Ontario, but we won't buy equipment for our military. And that's got to be an irritant, I'm sure, for the U.S.
Now, when you say military, you're not talking about the Mounties.
No, no.
These are like a step above, right? Like an actual military.
It's an actual military. We have our own Navy. We have a huge coastline.
I don't think I've ever seen a Canadian military before, honestly. Like, I don't think I've ever in my life. And now I'm trying to go, and I'm not trying to be snarky or a mean person. I've just, the Mountie is so embedded in my head, and I know that's a policeman, essentially. It'd be like the same level of authoritarian. Like, an army is a, like, that's like total control. And so, like, what color are your, you guys have robin egg green, blue, like the UN too? Or what color are your helmets and things like that?
Well, I think it's just the camouflage, the usual.
Okay.
But it's just, there's just not much of it. I think we have like a couple of air bases in Canada. And for the size of we're the second biggest country in the world, and we have like two air bases. And
well, I remember when Ron Paul, do you know who Ron Paul is?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so Ron Paul, you know, the libertarian Republican senator for many, many years, or maybe his House of Representatives down in Texas, and they were trying to ask him about Iran and his fears on Iran, and he just looked at everybody and said, "Are you kidding me? They don't even have an air force. I'm not concerned about Iran." And it was just so funny.
Yeah.
And I started thinking about that, going, I suppose there are a lot of countries that do not have the Marines, Navy, Air Force, Army. Oh. You know, like we got the four banger. And
oh, yeah. And what you're used to there is like you have everything, right? Like your military budget is like impressive. I mean, it's, you're a global military presence, and we're nothing.
What do they say, that if you took the U.S.'s budget for the military and then took every country in the world and combined it, it wouldn't even be half of what the U.S. spends or something
I believe it. Yeah,
yeah, it's astronomical.
Something monstrous. So,
look at that, folks. Little PSA. But
like even as a member of NATO, Canada's obligated to spend 2% of our GDP, I think it is, and we're not even close. We haven't been for forever. And when Trump was in last time around, he was admonishing Canada for not living up to our commitment. And we had Trudeau in power then, and we still have him, although he just ran out the side door. But we've never, there's been no attempt made to get to that number. So, which is shameful if you belong to a, anyways, different topic.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I've got a 3:30 here, so we got to wrap up in the next couple minutes. But I did want to ask you that if, let's just take oil and gas out for a second here.
Mm-hmm.
Maple syrup has got to be your number one export, right?
By, I don't think there's any pipelines that go to the U.S. that carry maple syrup, but it's probably some trucks. Yeah.
But I mean, as far as a commodity goes, is that one of your biggest exports?
No, it's a big visual, but it's not a big dollar value. What the number that irks Trump is, like, we have, I don't even know the number, but our trade surplus with the U.S. is well over $100 billion, and the majority of that is oil and gas, because we just send so much. I mean, we ship.
Oh, I disagree with you. Did you watch the football games this weekend?
Yes.
Do you watch American football up there?
Oh, yeah,
I know. I'm sorry we don't have six downs, but I mean, or whatever, and we only go 40 meters, that sort of thing. I'm sorry, I did make some CFL jokes in there. But so I think Canada's best export is the slime that Nickelodeon does. Because that came from You Can't Do That on Television, which was a Canadian show. And if you aren't getting, or if you don't have a tariff on the slime, boy, I don't know what to tell you guys, because that could that could pay for your army tenfold. Did you see the games? They had a cam, and the announcers were all in on it. What's that?
I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know it was Canadian.
Oh yeah, it came from "You Can't Do That on Television." Whenever somebody would say "I don't know," the slime would fall from their head, and it was SCTV was a Canadian show.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so "You Can't Do That on Television" was a kids' version.
Oh okay.
Yeah, and so that's where Alanis Morissette came from. That there you go. There's another one of Canada's best imports, Alanis Morissette. Well, you've apologized for Bryan Adams, so it's okay. Nine Inch Nails, baby. Yeah. They're from Ohio, aren't they?
Pennsylvania, I think. Yeah.
Pennsylvania. Like
yeah. Yeah.
Well, Ohio, Pennsylvania. That's right on the border there too. But
yeah.
Hey, you, where are you sending people to support your work, either by buying the book or by reading your articles?
The End of Fossil Fuel Insanity, yeah, it's at Amazon or Barnes & Noble and boereport.com. It's Canada's biggest, it's one of the world's biggest, I think, oil and gas news sites. It's a great site. It has energy info gathered from all over and some excellent columnists and things like that.
I'll ask like a podcaster and they will just... animation, bigger this, that. How many listeners do you got? Well, my mom listens. Okay. And here you are. Part of this. I think it's the biggest in the world. I don't know. Could be. I can't. We lost track after, we beat Switzerland. So
I don't own it. So it's if I did, I would care. But yeah.
Well, all right, man. You're an animal. That's for sure. We want to make sure we give a shout out to Terry Edom, Canada's greatest export. He beats the slime. Support his work, folks. Check him out. So I'm going to go ahead and hit stop on the record now. So thank you for your time today, Mr. Terry Edom.
Have a good day.